Hello, and welcome to Ipsa Dixit, a podcast on legal scholarship. I'm your host, Brian L. Fry, Spears Gilbert Professor of Law at the University of Kentucky College of Law. My guest is Henry Oliver, a writer, speaker, and brand consultant. We will discuss his new book, Second Act, What Late Bloomers Can Tell You About Reinventing Your Life, which is published by John Murray Press. So welcome to the show, Henry.
Hi, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I'm a big fan of your work. I've been reading your Substack. I really love your writing and your perspective on the world. Your piece on Mary Oliver was great and really thoughtful. So I appreciate that. And I'm very excited to have you here to talk about your new book.
Thank you so much. And you know, I love your work too. And more people should have your beliefs on plagiarism.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, so for listeners who may not have had the chance to read your book yet, which is still in production, I wonder if you could start by saying a little bit about what you mean by late bloomers and what you think their stories and what we know about them can tell us about success and what it means and how to achieve it.
A late bloomer is someone who is successful after the point when no one expects that they will be. So some people try and say like, oh, you have to be 40 or older or what, right? Well, that's going to vary a lot by, are you a tennis player? Are you a mathematician? Are you a historian? It's also just going to vary so much by individual. So I'm just saying a late bloomer is someone who is no longer expected to achieve anything. And then they come out and do something, right? Incredible. And there are examples of this in all disciplines, right? Through history, these people are important to the Renaissance, Silicon Valley, right? World literature. They're all over the place. And I just came to feel we didn't have a good book that kind of really got into it and said, like, what the hell is going on here? You know, who are these people? I think there are a whole category of people out there. And so the book is trying to say to you, like, if we look a little closer, some people have a lot more potential than we realize. And maybe they need to be in different circumstances. Maybe they need to change their peer group, right? Maybe it's a networking thing. Some combination of these things might bring out a lot more than like even they had anticipated. And so that's the basic message of the book.
So you start by telling the story of Katharine Graham, the former publisher of the Washington Post. Why did you find her story especially instructive? Or maybe just why do you think it's such a good illustration of the point you're trying to make in this book or the story you want to kind of people to start thinking about through this book?
There are several reasons why I picked Katharine Graham. The first one is that she was remarkably successful. It's not just that she ran the Washington Post and did the Pentagon Papers and Watergate and all these things. And there was a film, Steven Spielberg film about her. She was running the Washington Post company, which owned other newspapers, Newsweek, right? TV stations, radio. And so she was also a great CEO, one of the great CEOs of the 20th century. Warren Buffett invested in her. Right. Huge increases in the profitability of the company, huge growth. Obviously, it's not down to her alone. But what I thought we had here is it's actually a remarkable story. You could make several films about this woman. Right. We do the Pentagon Papers because that's a great story. But there's all these other things going on. And Anna Gatt, who runs Interintellect, said, oh, you should read her memoir. It's great. And I was so impressed by the book and by the fact that Katharine Graham had been sort of held back on purpose, if you like. And so she had come to think that she didn't have what it took. She'd been sort of bullied, I think you would say. And she had a very, very difficult marriage. Her husband was domineering. He was an alcoholic and he sort of belittled her all the time, right? And so when he very unfortunately killed himself, her life, it had what is quite rare, a real turning on a pin kind of moment where, you know, one minute you're sitting in the garden, the next minute you have the company now and you didn't think you would. And everyone said to her, you know, you've got to sell it. Friends were saying, get rid of it, you know, legal advice. And she said, I'll be damned if I'm going to sell it. Right? Real steel, real sort of impressive character. And when you look at it, this goes all the way back. all the way back through her life, she actually did have the preparation, the innate ability, she had the education. She had kind of been prepared for it. She did have what it takes, but she'd been made to believe that she didn't. And so it's a question of someone who has to rebuild their confidence, right? Sort of get into a situation where they think, I can't do this. You know, this is terrifying. And so she's incredibly impressive for being able to do that. And the third reason, which I'm afraid is slightly tawdry, is that it's a wonderful dramatic story. You know, it's awful to open a book with someone killing themselves. But it was a real kind of example to me of like, actually, she did just get dropped into that situation out of nowhere. She did. You couldn't have expected it. And my goodness, she became a superstar.
It is such a great story. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about sort of what prepared her or what enabled her to sort of step up to the plate when things really became, you know, when she needed to, right? Was it something that like the context in which she grew up, just something innate in her? What do you think was the sort of the secret sauce, as it were, that put her in the place where she could take the reins rather than do the obvious thing, which would have been to sell the paper or let someone take it over?
There are two things here. The first is a kind of innate quality. So she was always fascinated by the news. Her father owned newspapers. He was a political guy and a businessman. And so always she was fascinated by news. And even in the days when she's a sort of, you know, a repressed housewife who's being treated badly, she is just still fascinated by the news. You know, she never loses the bug. And so she has this kind of innate drive. You know, she just wants to be in the newsroom. And so when the paper comes in, you know, comes up and she can have it, it's like, well, it's not like we're saying, come and do something that you hate. Now, she didn't want to do business. She didn't want to do accounts. She didn't want to do all that side of it. But the news bug was so strong. And anyone who's had that, right? If you just love something, if you just want to be doing the thing, that's so, you know, motivation is really important for success. The second thing is her upbringing. She was very privileged. You know, and a big house, servants, right, successful father. He owned the Washington Post, you know, went to Chicago University, so very well educated. And so she obviously had all of these capabilities and had acquired all of these kind of skills that was reasonably rare for a woman at that time. Right? The world was not full of people who'd been brought up in that way. But she makes this wonderful story because at the same time that she is being brought up like this and being so privileged, she is constantly being told, you're not going to do this. And so it's this weird combination. And to me, it becomes very murky. Like it's so difficult to untangle it all. And that's what I think is the real lesson, is like the unpredictability, the difficulty of passing all that. And so many books like the one I've written will tell you what the social science says, as if there's this like big clean, so it's like push a button, you know, change your life. And Katharine Graham's a wonderful example of like, actually when life gets messy, it's just so messy, right? People are so messy. And so the innate and the upbringing, they sort of commingle, and then circumstances change everything. And she's able to draw on this kind of long history she has. And she's able to think way back and think, you know what? My father did actually say things that showed that he thought I was good, that they thought I had ability. You know, these things that hadn't been obvious, she can think back and say, yes, okay, he did support me with that. He did think I was good at that. But even when she wrote her memoirs years later, you know, she'd find old letters and just be, she couldn't believe what her life had been, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think if you want one thing, why did she become a success? The determination, you know, that rare level of like, I am going to grit this out.
Do you think there were other people who saw that in her before it fully manifested itself? Or was there more of like in hindsight, it was so obvious, even though it might not have been in the moment? And do you have the sense that like she knew that about herself, or was it something she kind of had to find in the moment or go through a process of discovering?
She talks a lot in her memoir about how she didn't know that about herself. It is, of course, conventional for very successful people and for very privileged people to say, it was nothing to do with me. You know, I had no great ability, etc. Because it's not noblesse oblige to sort of say, yeah, I was fantastic. And of course I deserve that. But I think in her case, you do have to weigh against that actually very few people said Kay could run the business. And when her father was dying, he decided to give it to her husband. Now, there were various reasons for this, but obviously what a shock that your father, and she was so institutionalized in this kind of way of thinking that at the time she thought that was a good idea. And she reads the letters back later on and she says, what the hell was I thinking? You know, how could I have been thinking this? So, and again, when she takes over the paper, she has the same thing where people, it's not even a question. Could she do it? They're not even really thinking in those terms. They're just saying, this woman, well, no, right? And so this is another thing. She's a really good case study of, sometimes people can't even, then it's not they can't see the talent in front of them. They're not even thinking about that. It's just impossible for them to get there, right? Because of these preconceived ideas. And that's a kind of quiet theme, but it's a running theme through the book. It is very, very difficult to get beyond your biases, and you're not going to know what they are at the time, right?
So one of the things that made the book a really fun read for me was the mix of sociological literature with kind of case study examples, fleshing out the points, yeah, which made them a lot more tangible. I wonder, kind of big picture wise, right? When you think about late bloomers kind of as a category, do you think that they tend to succeed for a lot of the same reasons, for really different reasons, or maybe some sort of mix of the two? There's some commonalities, but some things that are sort of unique to the circumstances.
It's definitely a mix. What I outlined a sort of theory in the book that there's an explore-exploit dynamic. There's a wonderful paper from Northwestern about hot streaks. You know, sometimes an artist or a sports person or a scientist or whoever will have maybe 10 or 15 years in their career where, you know, everything they do turns to gold, right? They make every goal. Every painting is a masterpiece, right? They start producing research papers and they're just changing their field, like whatever, you know? And a lot of people have this in their career. But the paper said, how do you get a hot streak? And their answer was, to begin with, you're in explore mode. And you're looking around, doing different things, trying things out. And then at some point, you go into exploit mode, where you pick, you know, one of these things or some combination of these things, and you just focus. You're not exploring and looking around anymore. You're focusing on doing it, executing it really well. So maybe if you're a scientist, maybe you've been in an academic job, right? And you're free to kind of do what you want. Now you're going to move to like a lab, a commercial operation, somewhere that's set up for delivery, right? If you're a sports person, maybe you change teams, whatever. What they say is, what matters is the switch. You have to have both phases and you have to choose at some point to say, I am going to switch. Now, when I read this paper, I thought, this came like at the end of my research. And I was like, this is exactly what I've been trying to say. These guys like meander and they have these kind of loose career, you know, they're not climbing the career ladder. They're kind of all over the place. But then at some point, they don't choose to switch very often, right? Your husband kills himself, right? Or something changes in your life. If you're a politician, you know, the wheel of fate turns, right? And then they switch into this exploit mode. And the three things I think that tend to do this are right people, right place, right time. So it's your network, it's some kind of change in circumstances, or this is a difficult phrase, but it's something like a midlife crisis, right? Some of these people, everything goes wrong, you know? And maybe it's them, maybe it's bad luck. Maybe they get up one day and look in the mirror and say, boy, I'm getting old. If I don't do it now, I'm going to run out of time. But something like that happens. And so even though individually, the details are very, very different in the way that, as you say, right, the case studies give you that kind of complexity. Some combination of right people, right place, right time is how they do it. I think it varies by individual, but also by discipline. If you're a politician, what you're going to have to be ready for is like things have changed, right? Politics is it has that quality, right? A year happens in a week kind of thing. If you're some sort of creative, like architect, writer, something, maybe it's more likely to be a midlife crisis or meeting a new group of people or something, right? So it will vary a bit like that as well.
You use another sort of paradigm in the book that I thought was interesting, which was this conceptual experimental distinction, which reminded me in some ways a little bit of like Isaiah Berlin's hedgehog fox distinction. I wonder if you could say a little bit about that. And, you know, is it related to the observation you were just making a moment ago?
It's totally related. This is a great question. I love this. I took this from David Galenson, who is an economist. Some people, this will be ringing a bell for some people because Malcolm Gladwell wrote about this in a New Yorker piece about late bloomers several years ago now. David Galenson, it's a wonderful book. And there are some papers, but he wrote a book, wonderful book. Everyone should read it. He looked at painters and writers. And he said some of them, the conceptual ones, right, they're born with this vision of the universe, Picasso, Keats, someone like this. And when they're very, very young, like 19, 20, they just start doing it. Right? And the work's coming out, and everyone's going, where did this person come from? Like, oh my God, this is a new thing. But by the time they're 30, like they're done. So the fascinating thing about Picasso is we see in the paper every now and then, Picasso sells for new record, right, X millions. These works are all the ones done in his 20s. The valuation of the later works really drops off, right? So Galenson says, then there's this other group, the experimenters, and they're like Cézanne, right? Cézanne's career hasn't really even started by the time Picasso has finished. And that's because he's not born with this great vision. He has to just keep experimenting. Every painting he does is not a finished thing. It's just an experiment. And he works out his vision like brushstroke by brushstroke. And it takes years and it's painful. And, it's the tortured artist, right? Like, oh my God, no one wants to go through this. But that's a really good study of creatives. And when I read that, I immediately said, this is Ray Kroc from McDonald's. This is not just about painters, right? And also, I had cut this out of the book, but David Ogilvy, the advertising mogul, he's exactly the same. This theory, you can apply it to the hamburger guy or the advertising guy, right? And so there's a chapter where I show, like, okay, it's French fries, it's not like oil paintings. But Ray Kroc was insane about French fries in the way that Cézanne was insane about painting apples. And he took it way too seriously. But that's one of the reasons why McDonald's is McDonald's, right? And so this is a bigger idea. And the experimental artist or the experimental, people more generally, they definitely, I think what Galenson picked up on was this meandering and this exploring. And then at some point they make that switch, they've worked it out, they've worked out their vision. Or in Ray Kroc's case, they drive into the car park at McDonald's and say, my God, what is this restaurant, right? And they can go into exploit. Whereas the Picassos and so on, they just kind of start exploiting really young. And it's a totally different paradigm, right? So yes, that chapter is a really good illustration of how long the exploration can go on and how hard it can be. And I think some people, their problem is they explore for too long. Like we all know these people, right? Their whole life they're dabbling. But some people, the famous Thomas Edison quote, they give up because they've been doing it. Oh God, it's been years and years and years. And he says, you had no idea how close you were. And so the Ray Kroc, I think Ray Kroc was 53 when he started with McDonald's. Very late to take what is essentially a single restaurant family business and turn it into the world's biggest company. But he does it. And it's a really good example of how late it can be with the experimenting. But again, he switched. He hadn't been in food before. He hadn't been in restaurants before. So he's bringing his past experience, all these experiments, but he switches into this new discipline. And obviously that's very execution focused. His job was to work out how you build more restaurants with franchisees and make it profitable. And that's what turned him into Ray Kroc.
So one of the, again, things that was really cool about the book was just how diverse the cast of characters really was. And a lot of the examples were really unexpected to me, which made them that much punchier and more salient.
In a lot of ways.
I hadn't thought about those people in the terms in which you described them. I wonder if you could give some examples of that and kind of giving people a kind of richer, deeper sense of what can constitute the kind of personal dynamic change that you refer to as being a late bloomer.
Sure. So some of the people who have a whole chapter to themselves, we have Samuel Johnson, who wrote a dictionary, who is famous for hundreds of reasons, right? For saying very sassy things, for writing a dictionary, for drinking a lot of tea. What I say is, actually, if we want to understand him, we've got to use network science. So there's a chapter there that talks about how he had a friend in a bookshop. And the friend, because the friend was a bookseller, he could organize publishers to fund the dictionary project. But the question is, who can write a dictionary? And he's like, I happen to know a really weird guy. I think he can write, right? And we then have Margaret Thatcher, British Prime Minister. Some people now, their skin is crawling and they're thinking, you know, oh my God, Margaret Thatcher. Whereas other people are getting out the flag. We're not here for politics, right? The interesting thing is she is also a network science story. People often say she became the leader because famously it was a former spy who ran her campaign and he lied about the votes to going around to politicians to scare them into voting for her. But again, it's actually the network science. He had the access to those people. He had the respect to those people. He could get their ear in a way others couldn't. And this is really the critical thing. And so with those two, the question of late blooming is like, they both were thought of by their peers as quite weird, quite marginal figures, like obviously high ability, but just irritating, strange. My God, like, you know, people are constantly saying about Margaret Thatcher, oh, we can't have her. She'll be such a pain in the arse. You know, you never get rid of her. Like, they have to use their network because they can't do it themselves. Then there's Frank Lloyd Wright, the great American architect, who is one of my favorites because he has this stellar career, very, very famous, you know, makes all these great houses. And then just it crashes. A total midlife crisis, leaves his family, practice goes into decline. He tries to recover it. He does some great work in the 20s in Japan, and then he gets the Great Depression. And he's 60, and everyone says he's washed up. And he starts an academy. And through this academy, he gets new work. He's had years of zero commissions, right? Really bad. And he has literally his whole career again. More than half of his total output comes after the age of 68. And we're talking about things like the Guggenheim, Falling Water, right? The book, the things that are on book covers, the buildings everybody knows. Amazing works. And he really turns that midlife crisis into a kind of renewal. And he just lives his whole career again. It's the re-examined life. And maybe my favorite is Audrey Sutherland, a kayaker from Hawaii, who starts exploring the coastline of Hawaiian Islands in her 40s, decides she needs a kayak, gets mocked because it's an inflatable orange kayak because she's not very tall and she's a woman and she's on her own. So she has to be able to pull this thing, you know, through the waves and so forth. And she ends up solo exploring the coast of Alaska and British Columbia in her 60s and 70s. First time in Arctic waters, solo bear encounters, right out for weeks at a time. Incredible. Incredible for anyone to do that, let alone this pensionable age woman going on her own who is not a professional. And I spoke to her kids and I said, when she starts going out aged 40, does anyone have any idea? Is anyone thinking she's going to end up, you know, solo exploring the Alaskan coast and having bear encounters? And they said, oh my God, no one had any, this really was not on the cards. So she's a fantastic example of how you can slowly build yourself out, right? And accrue this kind of experience and become something else. So those are three kind of different models of it.
So when you were writing this book, how did you sort of conceptualize your primary audience for the story or for the ideas that you were trying to convey? I mean, do you see this as being like a book for people who feel like they're unsuccessful and want to grab success, for like successful people who feel unsatisfied with something that they're doing, some other group of people? Like, who do you see as kind of being most likely to benefit from the insights in this book?
There are three groups that I would really love to get a hold of the book. The first, exactly as you say, is people who don't feel successful, right? Maybe you're middle-aged, maybe you've been trying for a few years, maybe it's just never quite come together. This book, I think, is there are lots of people like that in this book. The second group is exactly the ones who have already been successful, because there's a whole section, like Frank Lloyd Reich, about these double bloomers. Right. And I think actually we should pay attention to that. And if you're retired, right, if you're in the boomer population, maybe there's a whole, you could do a Frank Lloyd Wright, right? 68 and starts again. Like, great. You don't have to have a career. You could do other things, but like, that's a whole audience. And then the third audience, which I think is really important, is a kind of business audience, investors, recruiters, business leaders, anyone with a professional interest in talent, finding it, nurturing it, spotting it, recruiting it. There's a lot about talent in this book. There's a lot of research about talent in the book. And I'm hoping it will make you think a little bit differently about what talent is and how we assess it.
Well, so it kind of in closing, if people want to kind of think about how to maximize their chance of becoming a late bloomer and having the kind of second chance that you describe in the book and encourage people to seek, what are some sort of key points or observations or concepts or just maybe even things to think about or to be aware of in getting themselves to that place where that's a possibility for them?
One of the lines in the book, I put this on my blog recently and a few people responded to it. I say, you do not simply wake up one day and discover that you are Toni Morrison, right? And sometimes people say to me, oh, I think I'm going to be a late bloomer. And I say, oh, really? In what way? This is great. And they have no idea. They just sort of have this vague idea that they're going to wake up one day and like they will bloom. And what I hope you will see again and again throughout the book is there's always a long period of quiet work beforehand, right? So if you're not doing that already, get to it. Yeah, it doesn't have to be the greatest work you've ever done. You just have to start now and keep going. Persistence is a huge, huge theme in the book. For anyone who's been persisting and has accrued all this stuff, start looking for opportunities. And there's a chapter on luck that I think is really important, where I point out that some people are luckier than others, and they tend to be doing more and doing it quickly, right? And the more opportunities you create for yourself, the more opportunities you'll start spotting as they go past, and the more open the greater your surface area of luck. Someone wrote that famous article once. So those are the two main points, I think, and it's summed up in some advice from Audrey Sutherland. She said, "What have you done today?" And this woman, she's a single mother, four children, right, working a full-time job. She manages to do all this wonderful stuff. And she says, look, you can't go out kayaking today. Get the map out, repair the boat, think about what supplies you're going to put in. Go and look for secondhand rope that's good quality. Repair your kit. Like, what can you do today? And I think that is just always good advice.
Well, Henry, thanks so much for coming on the program to talk about your book. I loved it. It spoke to me in a lot of ways personally, and helped me actually in some ways better understand my own professional path. So I really appreciate that.
Oh, I'm really, really pleased to hear that. Thank you.
watch each move you make. I'll watch each step you take. In future years you may get lonely, dear. Should there ever be that day, then I'll just hope and pray that I'll be first to have a second chance with you. First to have a second chance with you. First to cheer you when you're sad and blue. Should there ever be that day, then I'll just hope and pray that I'll be first to have a second chance with you. Chance with you.